Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show. Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, I'm pleased to welcome Brad Berzer. Brad is a professor of history and the Russell Amos Kirk Chair in American Studies at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. He's the author of an eclectic group of books. They range from biographies on Andrew Jackson to Russell Kirk and the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien. He's also the co-founder of an online magazine, The Imaginative Conservative. In full disclosure, Brad's wife, Deidre, is the editor of the South Dakota Historical Society Press. But this discussion was not her idea. It was prompted by my desire to find an America 250 themed work. And when I saw Brad had a book coming out on the Declaration, I thought, well, great, I'll ask him to come on the show. And he agreed. So his book, The Declaration of Independence, A Radical Experiment in Liberty, is just out last week, I think. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And Brad also will be providing the awards luncheon presentation at our upcoming annual conference in June. So based on when you hear this, you may be able to buy a ticket and come. Or if you've missed the conference, you will be able to see it online a few months from now. Or as I alluded to, the topic of the discussion today is his new book on the Declaration of Independence. So Brad, welcome to History 605.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to talk to you. As you know, you're not only my wife's boss, but you've become a friend and an ally, and that's been great. So yeah. Really, really enjoyed getting to know you, and I'm glad we're able to do this.
Well, yeah, we've had the opportunity to chat on few occasions, I guess, two or three occasions where we've shared a meal over lunch or something like that, and enjoyed getting to know you, and was really pleased to see you had this book coming out. And I've done a series of shows, certainly this podcast on the history of South Dakota or the Northern Plains or the Midwest. We've stuck with that, but with America's 250 being in the air this year in 2026, I've done, in the ramp up to that, I've done a number of podcasts on America 250 themes. And so very glad to kind of dive in on your book today about the Declaration, which is the origins of the nation. In many ways, and kind of our well, as Martin Luther King would call it, a promissory note. Some have called it the Charter of the Nation. Abraham Lincoln referred to it as the golden apple. I'm paraphrasing a bit, but the golden apple, right, with the silver frame,
right,
of the Constitution.
With the frame
it.
Of silver. Yeah, absolutely.
So it is essentially something that we've striven for. So I'm wondering, you talk about in the introduction to your book kind of what prompted you to put this together. It sounds like it was a 250 themed publication. Is that correct, that you were doing it for 2026?
Yeah, that's right, Ben. It was actually, it was exactly 2 years ago. And in fact, it may have even been 2 years ago today or tomorrow. It was right at the end of the semester, and I got a call from the oldest think tank in America, the American Institute of Economic Research, AIER, which is in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And they solicited the book from me. They said, look, we've got the 250th anniversary coming up. We want to do something for this. They were actually restarting their own press. So they call it Stonehouse Press.
Okay.
And so they wanted to have a book to relaunch the press itself. And so this was it. And I've spent the last, I had other projects that I was working on at the time, but I was able to kind of put them to the side and then do this one. And I've had a great time doing it. I think I even mentioned in the book that, you know, I started it on a July 4th and I finished it on the following July 5th. And it was a great, I tried to finish it on July 4th, but that day got away from me and I finished it the next day. But I thought, how cool would that have been if I had done it, you know, exactly 1 year apart? So that's where it comes from, Ben. And I've also, I've been at Hillsdale now. I just finished my 27th year. Wow. And I teach American Founding every other year. So every fourth semester, I teach it. I'm taken with a lot of different schools of thought that go into the founding. And one of the things that I really wanted to do in this book was really blend like 5 or 6, maybe even 7 or 8 schools of thought and kind of show how they all have something to contribute to our understanding of the founding. So that was a goal.
Well, and I think you do make the point. And one of the things that I think is remarkably unifying about the Declaration of Independence is that all of these different schools of thought, which then morph in various forms into political viewpoints, different ideologies, and different frames of reference, they can all find a home in the Declaration of Independence. How do you, and you probably take students through that too, how do you kind of wire diagram, say, pick a school of thought. I don't know. Franklin Roosevelt, right? How do you take Franklin Roosevelt, who would be a very different American president from Calvin Coolidge, let's say.
Sure.
Contemporaries in many ways, but they viewed the same document in very different ways, but yet they can still find a home there. That's kind of remarkable in a way. And how do you wire diagram FDR into the Declaration and Calvin Coolidge into the Declaration?
Well, yeah. So you think about someone like FDR, and there was such a project around him through Arthur Schlesinger and other figures at the time, Bernard DeVoto. They were all really trying to show that what Roosevelt was doing was really rooted not only in Andrew Jackson, but also then in Thomas Jefferson. And so they kind of rewrite history. Jefferson, I don't know if he would have been a Democrat, but they make him a Democrat. Uh-huh. They make him the founder of the Democratic Party. And they show that lineage. So it's Jefferson, Jackson, Wilson, FDR, right? And so that's a big part of it. But then you have someone like Calvin Coolidge, as a very, very conservative Republican. And he sees the argument of the Founding Fathers, and specifically of the Declaration, as one that concludes a debate, doesn't start a debate.
Yeah.
And so that's a very different, if the Declaration is an ending point, that's very different than the Declaration being a beginning point. And I think I have to admit, Ben, I side much more with Coolidge on that than I do with FDR. And I think Coolidge had a proper understanding historically of what was going on. Whereas I think, again, FDR was really trying to manipulate the past for his own political advantage. Something that we would never, whatever Calvin Coolidge's faults were, we would never say he was manipulating the past. It's just, that's not Coolidge at all in any way, shape, or form. So, yeah, you've got, even though you've got the 1920s, the 1930s right there, they're looking at it very differently. But you also, and we see this with current figures, with AOC, with Bernie Sanders, one of the things that FDR tried to state was that the Declaration was an argument against the wealth of their day. Just like AOC said recently that the founding was an attack on the billionaires of their day. I don't think that's right. I think it's very wrong, actually. And I think it's somewhat dangerous to make that argument. But it's an old argument. And FDR had made that as early as the fall of 1932 in his Commonwealth Club address, where he argued that it was Jefferson versus Hamilton, right? And lays out a kind of classic dichotomy there. So anyway, this all gets caught up into politics, history, everything, Ben. And it's fun, but you can definitely go down a lot of rabbit trails with it.
That's the presentism, which one of the founding ethoses of this very podcast is to show people that casting your present ideas and understanding onto the past just leads to one misunderstanding after another. And if you're not careful, you yourself will be manipulated by people who are doing that very thing. So whether it's AOC or Calvin Coolidge, although I think to give, you know, Silent Cal kind of a break, I don't know that he manipulated much of anything. I don't know that he's been accused of
character.
Right. He was a successful political leader, both in his home state of Massachusetts, in the state house, became governor, and then to the vice presidency and the presidency. So I'm certain he had his ways of pushing buttons, but almost like Eisenhower, right? It's more, put the right people in the job that you want done, and you just let them do the job. And that's his way of manipulating things, which is also a way of governing your own passions about something in particular, right?
I have a real soft spot for Calvin Coolidge. I think the fact that his presidency was defined more by restraint than expansionism, I think that's a real compliment to him in many ways, right. and to the Republic. I think it's a great source of safety for the Republic. Very, very strong source.
As he himself said, right?
Absolutely.
Restraint is a great source of safety. I think that, what's that full quote?
It's
healthy for the Republic to realize that the president doesn't think he's a great man.
Right. Yeah. Right. And when he believes he's the only one who can save the Republic, he's guilty of treason.
Yes.
That's a beautiful, I love that.
He's, to use the musical phrase, he's riffing off of a line from the ancients, right? That you, getting back to the book here, we went down a rabbit hole, but the Declaration of Independence is founded on many ideas, and you spend chapters 1 through 5 going through kind of the events of the time on top of the ideas and how they were received by people filled with ideas about how things should be done or were to be done or what their rights were. Well, I see it even in your title, this radical experiment in liberty, the subtitle of your book, that can imply that Jefferson and Adams and Washington and the framers were all developing something completely brand new. And it wasn't brand new because they're taking ideas that are 2,500 years old in some cases.
That's right.
And they have, as Adams said, there's been a moral revolution going on in the minds of the American people starting the French and Indian War, or 20 years or so before the Declaration is even written, and that's where the war is really happening. And so now I think the thing that's new is this moral framework that's guiding politics instead of politics guiding the moral framework. Would that be?
That's really well stated, Ben. Yeah, I think that is something that's happening here. There was a great book that came out maybe 10 years ago by Brad Thompson on the moral revolution of the founding. And I was very taken with that book. And I thought, this is a really great way of thinking about something here that's profound. You know, where ethics and morality seems to trump politics. And I think that's one of the reasons we're so drawn to the founding, because it really wasn't a political moment. It was a moral moment where politics was an expression of that morality. And how rare is that in history? You know, where we see politics actually taking second stage to something greater than itself. Because politics by its very nature is imperialistic, right? It's always trying to expand. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. I don't think that's just a political statement. I think that's a truism historically. Right. And there are a few people like George Washington or Calvin Coolidge or Dwight D. Eisenhower who resist that. But I think they're really rare in history. Yeah. So that here we have a moment with the founding from 1761, really all the way up until about, Thomas Jefferson's presidency. Basically a generation and a half where we really are a very moral and ethical people trying to strive for virtue and these other things. And it is astounding. But Ben, I would also say this, and feel free to push back on this, but one of the things that I am so taken with the founding, and it's the same thing I'm taken with America, here we are deeply, deeply radical at the same time that we are deeply, deeply traditional. And I think that's one of the great paradoxes, not only of the founding, but of America. You know, so you can imagine with the founding, to give everybody religious toleration, that was unbelievably radical for its day. You know, that had never happened before anywhere. That was brand new. But at the same time, every one of our colonies adopted the common law. And the American Congress adopted the common law, something that's older than Christianity, right? It's pagan in its origins. And so there we are as Americans. We've just adopted the oldest known law code anywhere, but we're giving all these rights to everyone, and it's radical. And I love that. And I was thinking about this the other night. And again, Ben, I know this is not a political podcast, and I don't want to make this political. But, you know, imagine the kind of the best and the worst of America, where, you know, this was about 2 weeks ago. We had just orbited the moon, Artemis had. And I thought, okay, this is us at our absolute best. And if I remember right, and I may have this wrong, it may have been a Monday night. I was thinking it was a Tuesday night. But then we woke up the next morning, and during the night, President Trump had tweeted, right, he had put on social media that we were going to wipe out Iranian culture, right? We were going to bomb them back to the Stone Age. And it was just, you know, that, I'm not trying to make a comment on that, but just to think about that juxtaposition, here we are on the edge of the future, and here we are as savage as can be. And it's just so American in so many ways. And I see the, I don't see that downside to the founding, but I think with the founding, we're really trying to balance that. Are we an ancient people or are we a futuristic people? And it really is just so American.
Yeah, well put. On the cover of the book, it is Thomas Jefferson. And you state emphatically in the book that throughout, while he might not be mentioned on the page, certainly that he put his imprint and his mind as the first drafter of the Declaration of Independence. What does that mean to have, and maybe this kind of goes to what you were just saying, a man who owns other human beings, leading in rhetoric, if not in certain habits and forms, this moral revolution?
That's such a hard question, Ben. It's a great question, but it's so hard. And I always get that from my students. You know, we're halfway through the semester, and some earnest, you know, brilliant young student will understandably raise their hand and say, but Dr. Berzer, they own slaves. And it's such a hard thing because you know, they know what they're doing is wrong. They know that. You see that if you look at the debates, you know, in August of 1787, where they're trying to decide if there should be slavery under the Constitution. You know, it's one of the most ruthless, telling debates of that summer, and they're tearing each other apart. You know, they recognize this is evil, this is wrong, this is unethical, this is immoral, but yet then they make the choice to go ahead and allow it. And, you know, when you look at something like the Declaration, you know, and again, let's just put Jefferson to the side for a moment because he's a complicated figure. But we look at what he says. When he says all men are created equal, that is a statement you cannot back away from. You know, once you have made that statement, there is nowhere else to go except towards that radical dignity. And we know that when Jefferson said that, it wasn't all white men. Or it wasn't all men except Missouri Synod Lutherans or Jews or whatever it may be. Right. It was all men because there's that further paragraph in the Declaration where that was cut out by Congress that said, you know, we blame the king for taking men who had never offended them from a foreign country and imposing slavery upon them. And Jefferson in that says, you know, it's all capital, M-E-N, three capital letters, right? These are men. And so from all the textual evidence, we know Jefferson meant everyone. And yet, Ben, as you bring up, you know, and I get worked up about this, but, you know, there's Jefferson owning slaves. And man, that's hard. It's so hard to reconcile because, again, he knew it was wrong. The best book I've seen on this, I don't know if you've had a chance to read this, Ben. It came out 2 years ago. by Kara Rogers Stevens, brilliant, so brilliant she's been young on the scholar. Yeah. Oh, she's amazing. Yeah. Right? And I think the future of our profession. And her book, Thomas Jefferson and Slavery, that to me is the definitive statement on what's mm-hmm. going on here. Yes, Jefferson was anti-slavery. He was also deeply racist, right? And that, and you kind of have to live with that contradiction. But you look at someone like George Mason, who released his slaves. You look at someone like mm-hmm. George Washington, who released his slaves. So there are a lot of guys doing the right thing. Jefferson mm-hmm. just wasn't among them.
Well, Washington, at his death, frees the slaves he can, right?
Right, exactly.
Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to enslave, I guess, to to steal some Shakespeare and modify it to our purposes here. But
And of course, Ben, you and I have our sins too. They may not be sins, right? But I mean, clearly they're not those sins. Right. But we have our own. And every human being, of course, is a complicated story.
Right. Cast the first stone, as it were, right?
Yeah.
I think one of the revealing things about your book is that it is the events leading up to the Declaration and kind of the, as the phrase from the Declaration says, the long train of abuses.
Right.
I appreciate what you do in chapters 1 through 5, where you kind of contextualize the Boston Massacre and the Boston Tea Party and the other events that drive them to do something that it's just unthinkable and separate from the king's political authority, and how that they've tolerated this and now they no longer can, largely on the moral revolution that's gone on in the minds of the American people. At least some of them, enough of them, right, to carry the thought through and the action of, and to be excited about the, when the Declaration of Independence is publicized, to read it and say, yeah, that's how we think. Talk about that, the mind of the American people, as far as Jefferson is concerned. He's given quite rightly credit for being the lead author, but he's, I heard someone recently say, in many respects, the Declaration of Independence is a cut and paste job. He's snatching ideas that are in the water. You mentioned George Mason, I think, and others that are writing, John Dickinson, who are writing a lot of things, and he's taking all of these that he knows are finding a resonance in the population and putting it all in there. And he's trying very hard not to make it a Thomas Jefferson document, but to make it a one that the Second Continental Congress can get behind. What's the writing process like then in the hot summer in Philadelphia in 1776?
Yeah. Again, Ben, great question. It's really interesting. If we go to Jefferson a year, about 14 months before he dies, so this would be May of 1825. He is asked by Robert E. Lee's father, what was the inspiration for the Declaration? And he says, well, there was absolutely... Now, remember, this is 49 years after he wrote it. He's an old man.
Right.
He's close to death. He doesn't know that, but he's close to death. And probably there's a lot of nostalgia in what he says. But he does say this was the common sense of the subject, to put in terms so plain as to command the assent of mankind, right? It was the American mind. And I love that because it means, and it makes sense logically, right? If Jefferson were just some radical with 1,000 new ideas, nobody would have bought into it, right?
Like
he would just be some nut job. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yet by giving expression to what everybody believed, it is Jefferson. And it's not Jefferson. It's something beyond him. Mm-hmm. And so that's a huge part of what I tried to do in the book. I tried to figure out what was that common sense of the subject. And this is where, for us, Ben, you and me and every one of our generation and the upcoming generations, we find this so hard to understand. The American founders are a number of things, right? They are first and foremost Englishmen. Right. They are deeply rooted in the common law. They're rooted in the parliamentary tradition. They're rooted in the whole understanding of Anglo-Saxon culture, not race. I want to make that clear. It's not the white race. It's the culture that matters. And it is a brilliant culture. I think it's one of the finest cultures ever to exist anywhere. I don't have a drop of Anglo-Saxon blood in me, but I'm very, very glad to be in an Anglo-Saxon culture. Extremely glad under common law. And, you know, maybe we can talk more about that.
Sure.
But so first of all, they're Englishmen. Second of all, almost equally important, they are to a man deeply Protestant, right? These are not... You know, and I say that as a Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. These are an utterly Protestant people. These are people right out of the Reformation. You know, the Reformation wasn't something that happened to their great-great-grandparents. Mm-hmm. They are a Reformational people. You know, when they settle New England, when they settle Virginia, they are in the midst of their Reformation and their Civil War over religious ideals. So this isn't, you know, Luther. We're talking Anglicanism versus Calvinism, you know, and Baptists, and this is a serious, serious thing for them. And so it just defines, and I think, and I get frustrated when I see people say, well, there's so much of a deistic element to the founding. There's really not. You have three great deists. You've got Thomas Jefferson, you've got Ben Franklin, you have Benjamin Rush, and they're really important. They're really, really important. But they're it, right? There's no deistic movement in America. It's three guys who happen to be really influential, but that's about it. So again, these people, you know, they're King James Version or Geneva Version of the Bible. They're just hardcore Protestants, and we can never escape that. But the third thing I would say about them, Ben, is they're very classical, and they love the liberal arts. They love the classics. They love Cicero, Tacitus, Livy. They're not so taken with the Greeks. The Greeks never really have a huge influence on the Americans, but the Romans have a huge influence on the Americans. And you know, all we have to do, Ben, is look at our Capitol building.
Yeah,
it's a Roman building. You know, the Capitol building is a second century BC Roman building. Mm-hmm. We could have made it to look like the Taj Mahal or Parliament or a European cathedral or the Hanging Gardens. We make it a Roman Republican building. Mm-hmm. And we name our upper legislature the Senate after the Roman Senate. And we take, you know, the names like Publius and Cato and Brutus. You know, these are all deeply Roman names that we think of. And, you know, we are essentially the new Romans. So when we look at what's going on with the founding and what Jefferson is doing, he's really combining, even though he's a deist, he's combining Anglo-Saxon culture, Protestantism, and classicism, right? Yeah. All of that. And so that's, and that would be, and again, I think this is a world that's just lost to us, Ben, but you know, any school child who would have gone to any schooling at all, let's say that you're a Western Massachusetts farm kid. So maybe you went to school when you were 8, 9, and 10 before you could actually work on the farm. Once you're 10, you're a laborer on the farm. Mm-hmm. But as a little kid, maybe you got to go to school. The only thing you would have studied in school was Greek and Latin. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that we think of school is for reading, writing, and arithmetic, that was stuff you did at home, not stuff you did in school. School was only learning Latin and Greek. And, you know, this is, and I'm sure you know this, Ben, as well, but I always love this. You know, when we're at the Battle of Yorktown and it's 2/3 French and 1/3 American, hardly any Americans speak French and hardly any French speak English. All of the battlefield orders in Yorktown are in Latin. Yes, it's the only common language we speak. So you've got these guys going into battle yelling in Latin. That's incredible. Oh, wow. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
That's a Roman battle.
It's a world. It's a world we've totally lost. Right. It's even with our revival of classical schools right now, it would take us a century to get back to that.
Let me test that theory a little bit. So if you're living on a farm in Western Massachusetts in the 1750s, who would teach you your reading, writing, and arithmetic?
Oh, it would be your mother,
right?
Right, right. Yes, the reading, writing, arithmetic would be your mom and dad. Yep, yeah, absolutely.
And this is why the Reformation is so critical, I think, to your argument, is that much of the Reformation is the ability to read the scripture for yourself.
Exactly. Exactly.
And get the priest or the pope out of the way of your own salvation. Yep. I'm riffing off of Luther there, I think.
No, that's too. A fair assessment. Yes.
So just absolutely. The fact that the Reformation has happened sets up the ability for a lot of that schooling to be going on in the home.
Yeah.
And then for school then to be thought of as maybe specialized for future lawyers, ministers, certainly engineering as such kind of is emerging with the Enlightenment and things like that. But yeah, to be getting the latest from what Dr. Franklin might be writing about various scientific experiments that he and others are doing in Europe, and to be learning Latin and Greek. Again, for the work of the salvation of your soul, not necessarily to get a job, right?
No, that's right. And it was also to be a citizen, to be not just a citizen of the colony, but a citizen of the world. Mm-hmm. So if you know Greek and Latin, you're automatically, it's not elitist. It's about a common citizenship that we all share going back to the Greeks and the Romans. So it's not practical, and yet it has a practical element to it. Right. As well. And almost always your Latin and Greek teachers would have been your local minister, especially, you know, everywhere the Calvinists go, they take with them Calvin's Institutes, the Geneva Bible, and the classics. Yeah. Right? They're deeply rooted in the classics. And we don't think about this very often. And this is all thanks to Protestantism. You look at a place like New England, you've never seen literacy rates like that ever. In the history of the world, you're talking about close to 99% literacy in Massachusetts. That's incredible. Just amazing. And it's men and women. It's not just men, right? It's men and women. So really amazing.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's indicative of, you look at across literacy test scores today, Massachusetts is always leading the league.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Whether for different reasons, but out of that same tradition, I guess. That would be an interesting historical study to do, is to see the connection between their performance and outcomes today versus their performance and outcomes such as it can be known, which is really tough to equate. But
that's true.
There's another rabbit hole we could go down some other time.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can talk about how Cicero's The Republic formulates, in the more broadly speaking, I guess the question I'm angling toward is the ancient understanding of what it is to be human is the realization that the best government is that government which models humanity itself.
Right.
And how do we understand humanity itself? Well, it's by looking at traditions that have over time proven to work. This is one of these things. This is the common law tradition, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So that comes through in your book. And I wonder if you could expound a little bit too. Nobody reads Cicero anymore, I think, other than maybe in a college course. He's talked about from time to time, but diving in and reading him can be certainly rare, if not a chore, but the founders are reading him all the time and talking about how they're reading him all the time. Can you speak about what's so attractive about Cicero's writings and what's so insightful about what he's saying that they try to mirror that in what ultimately becomes the Constitution?
Right.
It's kind of assumed in the Declaration that the king has broken that model. They want to get back to that. So then how do they're attempting to craft a constitution that won't, like the Roman Republic did, slide into despotism.
Right.
So how do they do that?
Right. Well, so let me answer that with a couple of strains of thought.
Okay.
So let's set common law aside for a moment and think about natural law with Cicero in particular.
Okay.
And so this is, and I know your listeners can't see me, But this is the way that the Greeks and the Romans, that the classics, the way they thought about government and why a republic was the most important form of government. So they divided a government and an understanding of government by the three parts of the human person. And the way, and again, I know your listeners can't see me, but it was divided by the head and the chest and the stomach. And so this is how, and Plato talks about this. You see this in the Republic, some of his other writings, and Cicero's very much playing off of Plato, very much. I mean, basically 100%. And you see it later in C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man. He makes the same argument. Mm. But the head is always associated with rationality, and therefore it's associated with the king or the president. Right, for us in America, it would be the president rather than the king. The stomach is always associated, and the procreative region, so the stomach and below, that's always associated with our passions. So, you know, I'm hungry, I go eat, I find her beautiful, I'm going to chase her down, whatever it may be, right? So lust, hunger, those kinds of things, that's the stomach. That is always, and I realize that this gets into modern complications, but that is always associated with the democratic part of us. It's our passions.
Yeah.
And then in the middle, the most important part is our chest. And so the heart or the soul, the chest. The chest is always associated with aristocracy. So the head, monarchy, the chest, aristocracy, the stomach, democracy. Okay. And it's in the chest that we are actually most human and least human. Because when we talk about the chest, we're talking about reason, not rationality. Rationality is saying A is A, or A plus B is C, or 1 + 1 = 2. That's our rationality. But reason is me looking at you, Ben, and not just seeing another white guy my age, but actually seeing a person made in the image of God. Reason is the ability to imagine the divine in another person. And that's why, and of course, think about this from a Christian perspective, John 1:9, what is the Logos? The light that lighteth up every man. Right? It's okay. That image of God projected into the soul. And you see that as far back as Socrates. Socrates is already saying that. Cicero says that in On the Laws. What is the soul? It is the voice of reason. So in the modern world, we tend to think of reason and rationality as the same. That is not true in the ancient world. They're very different. Rationality is the mind thinking. Reason is the ability to see the divine in another person. And so you think about, again, to use another Christian example, think about when Mary is, the Virgin Mary, when she meets the angel and she says, my soul doth magnify the Lord, right? She's not doing anything other than submitting to God. She's saying, my soul reflects you, right? That's reason.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's how they break it down. So what Cicero tells us is that a republic is the best form of government because in its three branches of government, it reflects the human mind and the human soul and the human stomach. So we have the head, the executive branch. We have the heart or the soul, the Senate or the Supreme Court. And then we have the democracy, the House of Representatives, and it's a reflection of human nature. So when they talk about natural law, when the founders talk about natural law, it is truly the projection of the human being on society. And so that's why it's so good and it's so healthy. But think about this, Ben, it's also deeply fragile. You know, when I walk into a grocery store, I need to be rational. I need to look at prices. I need to look at quality. I don't want to be ruled by my passions. If I'm ruled by my passions, I'm going to buy the party pack of M&Ms, right? If I'm ruled by my rationality, I'm going to look at choice cuts of meat and measure those. right? So you don't want that. But at the same time, you know, if we're thinking about having children, nobody wants to be rational about that. You want your passions to rule, right? Uh-huh. And so those, they're both equally important parts to who we are, but they're different parts. And so it's the soul, it's the chest that navigates between the head and the stomach. So if we're only rational, we're robots. If we're only passionate, we're hedonists. And so to be human, it has to be all three. And that's where the founders, and for them, that would have been just a common argument. So when the Constitution has Article 1, 2, and 3, this makes perfect sense to the founders. All they're doing is imitating the human person. That's why, and I get worked up about this, we are not a democracy. We are absolutely not a democracy because we're not ruled by our passions. We are a republic. It has to be a balance of all three things. And you know, we're at a moment in time where the democratic part of our government is pretty impotent. You know, Congress has not really had power since World War II. The presidency has gained so much power, and the Supreme Court has so much power, but we're out of whack right now. You know, there's not a balance, and we need to strive to find that balance again. You know, Congress needs to reclaim a lot of its authority, which it's just given over in so many ways, to the presidency in particular, especially in the war power. Right. Yeah, that is just amazing from a constitutional perspective. But that, so Ben, I apologize. I went on too long about that. But that's what's going on with the body and the three articles.
So does that reflect then too their frustration with the king or the British government as a total?
Oh, absolutely.
In the 1770s, they're saying you've lost the thread, man. I guess as we would say today, right? You've lost your purpose. You're off the reservation. Any number of things. You've lost your soul.
Yes.
And we, meaning that the people in the colonies we're just trying to get back to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And absolutely. And again, that takes us back, Ben, to the idea that we're both very radical and very traditional, because in many ways, the American Revolution is a restatement that. You can't change us. We are what we are, and we're going to stay the way we are. And you don't have the right to manipulate that. King is the innovator, not the Americans. And it's very reformational, too.
Yes.
Right? I mean, this is Luther's argument as well, right? Luther claims he's the real Catholic, right? He's not a Protestant, right? He sees himself as the real Catholic.
He's not
trained. And that's what the Americans are doing as well.
Right. Yes, Luther sees himself as not trying to split off or to be divisive. He's just saying,
correcting what had gone wrong.
You need to quit raising money from penances for St. Paul's or St. Peter's Basilica. That's not biblical.
Exactly.
You've got some theological problems, and you need to get back on the.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right.
Right. Your students probably. Enjoy these conversations about that, because sooner or later you come down to what is the nature of truth? How do you know what is true? Chapter 6 is a real rewarding part of this.
I had a blast. My favorite part was chapter 5 and chapter 6. Those were my two favorite chapters. Yeah.
But the notion of what is true is timeless, I guess, if I'm to paraphrase what you're saying. If it's true for Cicero, if it's true for Aristotle, it's true for us today.
Yeah, whether you're for all men and women, every place, everywhere. And that's Cicero's argument, where he says, if we believe in the natural law, there can't be a law for Athens and Rome or one for the past and the future, but one law for all people. And, you know, again, Ben, I know you're not asking this, but to get back to our question of race, you know, one of the great things about Western civilization, especially Socratic and Ciceronian civilization, is we have always looked at the universality of man, not at the particular of man. So it's not Greek or Jew or black or white or male or female. It's a universal understanding. It's actually extremely anti-racist in every way. Because it's trying to find commonality. And that, right. You know, we go all the way back to the beginnings of Greek philosophy, about 60 years before Socrates. You know, these guys like Heraclitus and Thales, they're all debating what makes us human, not what makes you something and me something, but all of us the same thing. And there we get back to the declaration, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. It's a fundamental statement, deeply traditional and deeply radical at the same time.
Well, I could go a number of different ways with that. But so with your students today in your classes, when they say, well, what is, I think it's the Ben Jonson poem, what is truth, suggesting Pilate, and would not stay for an answer, right? Do they stay for that answer that there are universal truths, no matter your skin color or your sex or your political viewpoint or something, that, that hold water?
Yeah.
Do they buy that? I would say, do your students push on that? How does that come out?
Yeah, mine do, but I don't, but I'm at a very conservative traditional school.
Sure.
And so, you know, my students are, there are a lot of homeschooled students. They're deeply religious, both Catholic and Protestant, majority Protestant, but probably about a third Catholic. So they're coming to the classroom already believing in objective truth. So I can't answer that, Ben, because if I were, say, at Michigan State or the University of Michigan, I might get pushback on that. I don't get pushback on that at Hillsdale. That may just be my, you know, the pond where I find myself swimming.
It probably is, because I've gotten, well, when we talk about the rightness or the wrongness of holding another human being in slavery, and other colleagues have tried to explain the rightness or the wrongness of that as well, because students often from the Air Force Academy where I taught or at Dakota State where I taught, students often say, well, it's wrong because it's illegal, right? In other words, the ethics comes from the law instead of the other way around.
Yeah, I'd rather it be the other way around. I would rather it be illegal because it's unethical. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And certainly not that all law is just, but that's why you have courts to weigh the evidence and to look at the facts of the matter, weigh that against the law and the Constitution and a trial by jury, which I, just as an aside, I found it amazing that no one knows the origin of the jury trial.
Right.
I just assumed it was Magna Carta, but it precedes centuries.
It's older than Christianity.
Yeah,
we don't know where it came from. And what I think that's a good thing, because if we could just identify it with one person, well, then it's just an idea that anybody could have. But if it comes from a tradition and a whole people, that makes it real. Mm-hmm. In a kind of mystical way, it makes it real. And I love that. Absolutely love that.
But getting back to the point then, what precedes or what comes first? Is it law or ethics? And the point that you make and Brad Thompson makes in his book and that John Adams makes is that there's this moral revolution that's occurring in the minds of the American people. And from that, then the Declaration of Independence is an expression of that revolution that's concluding.
Right. Absolutely. I love that.
So it's fun to take students through that and then this kind of old saw, well, your truth is not my truth.
Once you say that, there's no way you can have a discussion, right? It's just the discussion's over.
I would, if you'd humor me for a second. So in my first deployment to Afghanistan, right? So on this idea that these truths are universal, no matter what your race or culture or ethnicity or sex or gender or what have you, I had a translator as a really energetic, fun, given his situation. And today he's an American citizen, lives in Omaha. I said to him, let's have a little fun poking at the Iranians, right? We would use Wikipedia and I was helping him craft some, and the faculty there craft curriculum for the Afghan cadets. This was my first tour in Afghanistan. This was my job. I was an advisor to the history department and the foreign language department.
That's really
their
interesting.
Military academy, which was one of the more bizarre experiences of my life, as you might imagine. So I'm helping them to formulate a class, broadly speaking, on the English-speaking world. And I can't remember the exact details of how we wound up on this, but we were trying to translate documents. And from time to time, he told me he would use Persian because it was a better way to express certain things than Dari, which is the language of instruction. And Persian was easily translated because their languages are very related. And so I started looking at Persian, and I realized, well, the Iranian government are really making Wikipedia in Persian. I'm sure they're editing this. I mean, they're constantly going in there and editing things that's said in Persian because that's their culture and language. They take that very deeply, you know, personally. So I said to him, we should translate the Declaration of Independence into Persian and put it on Wikipedia and see how long it lasts.
Yeah.
And that was one of the most instructive for me. I learned so much about the Declaration of Independence because I'm trying to explain it to this non-American.
Oh, sure.
Who doesn't speak English. His English skills were really strong, but nevertheless, he'd never lived in America or Britain. And so I'm trying to teach him all of this stuff about the origins of the ideas in the Declaration of Independence. And he rendered it into Persian. And I've not looked at it in a long time to see if it's still there. But
that's great.
But that's an example of, and my point of bringing all this up is, that's an example to counteract your assertion or anybody else's assertion that there's universal truths about the nature of freedom and natural law in a country like Afghanistan, which before it became predominantly Muslim, was not in the Western civilization tradition that you've been describing, and that has informed so much of our civilization. In other words, all men created equal? Nope. That is not a part of the Afghan tradition. And so do they want that? Well, that was the going in assumption of that whole war, was that they wanted it. Certainly fueled President Bush's foreign policy.
Oh, sure.
Everyone wants to be free. And I, in my own experience in Afghanistan, and I imagine other people's experiences around the world or with cultures maybe even that reside in the United States in various pockets, we're such a pluralistic nation, it's that is not a truism. Or is it? In other words, can you say that in Afghanistan, they just haven't had their moral revolution, or that their moral revolution that was experienced by the American colonists in the 17th, 18th century has not occurred there?
Yeah, Ben, it's, again, a wonderful question. And I would offer two points. Number one, yes, I think it's true. That is, I do think it's true for all men and women. Do I think that all men and women agree with me? No, of course not. Right. I think it's still one of those things that consciousness, culture has to evolve to understand those things. So again, this is where, you know, I don't have a drop of Anglo-Saxon blood in me. Right. I'm 98.7% Southern German, right? And I'm 1% Turkish, which I always think's hilarious. I try to do this. I don't do it every day, but I try never to take it for granted that I live in an English speaking country, because I truly believe that the Anglo-Saxon culture and Anglo-Saxon law, especially law, is the best form of law anywhere. I think that the English just got to it earlier than other people have. And I appreciate that. Again, I'm a patriot in that. But the other thing I would say is this, Ben, you know, think about think about the whole study of Western civilization. In its origin, it is the Greeks versus the Persians, right? The whole beginning of Western civilization is in opposition to Persia, right? So Persia, you have a god king where he is in charge of everything and nobody has equality. In Greece, it's the opposite. There is no God King, and we want everybody to have equality. So that, you know, when we're talking about even the Afghan war or any of that, you're really talking about stuff that's now 2,500 years old in opposition.
Yes.
And I think one of the craziest things in Western Civ is there are times we have become Persians. You know, you think about the Caesars in Rome. That's not part of the Western tradition. That was an Eastern tradition that was imported. You know, to have Nero, that's not Western. That's that's stealing from the Persians.
Well, but it is human, right?
Nero's, it is human.
Nero's
exactly.
head is broken. His stomach is governing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, again, there are things that we should aspire to, and then there are realities that are brick walls at times as well.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't want to... I am a Republican, small R Republican, but I don't want to be utopian.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. There you go. Regarding Afghanistan, I did find it. One of the other translators on the base there was, his name was Iskander, which is the Persian version of Alexander.
Of course.
And so there was a kind of a dusting of Greek culture, Hellenic culture in Afghanistan. And I found it highly ironic that, and that translator was General Petraeus's translator.
Wow.
He worked for the man himself and only him. So I would go to a pool of translators, but Iskander was General Petraeus's interpreter and translator. And I thought, well, it's very fitting.
Yeah.
The Greeks and the Persians are alive still here in Afghanistan. So
yeah, that's wonderful. That's a great story, Ben.
To the listening audiences on History 605, the book again is entitled The Declaration of Independence, A Radical Experiment in Liberty. You will learn so much about the ideas that go into the founding document from 250 years ago. I think you'll be enriched and deeply rewarded by reading the book. And Brad, thanks for taking from July 4th of 2024 to July 5th of 2025 to write this book.
My pleasure. It's so fun talking, Ben. Again, I just every time we get together, I just enjoy talking with you and more. Yeah. So I look forward to the future.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks here in Fort Pierre. Look forward to that.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, or the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that,
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.